Well, I think we should get started because I've constrained my panelists to short presentations, and I don't want to do that anymore. So, all right, welcome everybody. Green building, you know, over the last decade has grown phenomenally to the point that it's said that potentially as much as 40% of the commercial stock may be moving in this direction, and in the future, obviously, it's going to have to happen. We environmental journalists used to report mostly on natural resources, wildlife, birds and bunnies, but increasingly we are writing for real estate pages, arts and architecture, planning sections, and the status of green building is important beyond that. It's actually the built environment that is the world's largest source of demand for energy and the number one contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, not just in the U.S., but across the world. Buildings comprise half of the energy demand, and sometimes more. According to Ed Mazaria of the 2030 challenge, it may be as much as 60%. And when you look at the combined industrial and residential facilities, houses, shopping centers, commercial and so forth, it may be as much as 75%, I've seen, as a, you know, draw on energy demand. So dealing with this challenge, let alone thinking about the billions of square feet that China will be adding in terms of the new cities that they're building, you know, obviously we have to really hone in on energy efficiency and water efficiency for the building, for buildings and homes. And buildings are just the building blocks of cities. Sustainable cities is the focus of this conference. But so I hope that the panelists will look larger beyond the building, beyond the footprint, but I know they will. So with that, I'd like to introduce Heather Langford, who is from the U.S. Green Building Council. She oversees Demand Response Partnership, a collaborative effort between USGBC and the Environmental Defense Fund. She also works on the Lead for Existing Buildings recertification program, supports the advocacy team on greening building codes and standards, and contributes to the technical development of LEED. Go ahead.
Let's see. How do I turn this on?
Oh, is it not on?
Oh, it is on. Okay. Great. So good morning. I'm very happy to be here, and big thanks to SEJ for inviting us to participate. I'm going to talk to you about the bigger picture of the green building movement and what it's achieved to date, where it's going, but I'm going to do that within the context of USGBC and our LEED rating systems. LEED stands for, just in case there are folks out there who are new to this topic, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, and it's a rating system to assess buildings in the context of location and transportation, sustainable sites, water efficiency, energy and atmosphere, materials and resources, and indoor environmental quality. Let's see here. And just to point out, and I'll talk in a little bit more about this in just a moment, but the difference between a code and a rating system, a code tells you what to do, and a rating system tells you how well you did it. So a code is a requirement, and a rating system is a voluntary program. Since its founding in 1993, USGBC has been working to change the way buildings and communities are designed, built, and operated. We're made up of builders and environmentalists, corporations and nonprofits, teachers and students, lawmakers and citizens. We have 77 chapters across the United States with 13,000 member organizations and nearly 200,000 LEED accredited professionals. LEED has fundamentally changed the way people think about buildings as it continually is working to raise the bar on what we can and should expect from the built environment. As the world's most widely used and recognized green building rating system, we've spurred the growth of an entire green building industry, and according to McGraw-Hill, the green building industry is expected to be worth up to $140 billion in 2013 and up to $248 billion in 2016. So as technology providers and building product manufacturers have seen the demand for LEED grow, They have been working to provide solutions to help projects achieve LEED's demanding requirements that set LEED-certified projects apart from other buildings. And an example of this that you might be familiar with is low VOC paints, a volatile organic compound. And before LEED, they were very, very rare to find and not very good quality. And with the LEED rating system, where there are points that you can achieve for using low or no VOC paints, we've spurred this industry where now you can go into your Home Depot or your Lowe's or even your Ace Hardware and find a large selection and variety of these paints that are much, much more effective than they were even 5 years ago. So that's our approach, market transformation. We're looking to the market to drive the demand for healthy, sustainable buildings. And we're seeing a lot of success with that in commercial real estate and Class A buildings, and looking to improve the success in smaller buildings, as well as looking at the development of entire neighborhoods. So we're a rating system that's designed to acknowledge leadership for innovative, sustainable practices. We're not a code, but we work in tandem with codes. And one way to think of it is that a code is raising the floor of what standard practice requirements are. And as that floor raises, LEED continues to raise the ceiling to set the bar for higher achievement and more effectiveness. And so it creates this creative tension for us around what the market's ready for and the urgency of raising the ceiling of LEED due to climate change and all kinds of other issues and reasons for that. So it's always a balance for us, and especially when we come out with a new version of the rating system, to make sure that we're not pushing too far ahead, but that we're still pushing for leadership from those who choose to participate. So the ultimate goal is to have green building be the standard way of building. And we're getting there. We're not there. There's a long, long way to go. But the industry now, with the release of the International Green Construction Code, ASHRAE Standard 189.1, and the District of Columbia is getting ready to release a green building code that will be the first of its kind in the country. So that is going to the council and the mayor, I think, in the next couple of months, and they're hoping to have that approved and in place in 2014. Let's see where we are here. All right, and so this is just to show you just the point that I was just making about LEED and codes and where we're trying to go. And with each new version that comes out, to be working on deeper and deeper and deeper transformation, and thus having the codes go up higher and higher. So we're certifying 1.5 million square feet a day. We have more than 54,000 projects registered and certified in LEED, and that makes up 10.1 billion square feet of construction space. We also have made ongoing building performance a priority, and that's through our LEED for Existing Buildings Operations and Maintenance Program, where we're tracking building performance as well as helping building managers to implement best practices in the way that they operate their buildings. LEED projects are responsible for diverting over 80 million tons of waste from landfills. So that's expected to grow to 540 million tons by 2030. And greater building efficiency, looking into the future, can meet 85% of the demand for energy in the United States. Just a couple of examples, and then I'll wrap up my remarks. The LEED Gold Certified U.S. Treasury building has saved taxpayers $3.5 million per year in energy, water, and leasing costs. And compared to an average commercial building, the LEED Gold buildings in the General Service Administration's portfolio consume 25% less energy, 11% less water, 19% lower maintenance costs, 27% higher occupant satisfaction, 34% lower greenhouse gas emissions. So looking forward, as I mentioned, the big strategy is existing buildings. And also at USGBC, we're now working to be a global rating system for both new construction and retrofit projects. We are in 140 countries and territories around the world. And 40% of all the projects pursuing LEED are now located outside of the United States. And more than 50% of all LEED registered projects are outside of the U.S. U.S. So, 97 green building councils all around the world, and there's a World Green Building Council that brings these 97 together to coordinate and share and learn. We're working in Brazil, India, China, the UAE are seeing explosive growth in green building in recent years, and we actually just opened our first office in China, and we may be doing the same in India at some point in the future. So global is when we say looking into the future, not just focusing here on the United States, but taking lead internationally. We've done a lot of work in Europe, 488 certified projects, which represents 98 million square feet, and we have a lead international roundtable. We have alternative compliance paths for Europe, and we have this a lead earth campaign where if you're the first building to certify in your country, then you get free certification, so there are no costs to that certification. In closing, while we're often associated with new construction projects, in 2011, the square footage of our LEED certified existing buildings surpassed our LEED certified new construction, and that trend is continuing to this day. And we are now, with the LEED V4 coming out, have a very, very strong focus on performance and tracking and working with buildings to create and adhere to operational and maintenance protocols and procedures. So the last thing I want to say is I think from our perspective at USGBC, the biggest potential for creating a sustainable built environment is, one, beginning to work more and more internationally, and two, to focus on greening existing buildings. And I'll stop there.
Okay. Thanks so much. So I'm going to move now to Dennis Hayes, who's president of the Bullitt Foundation. And Dennis was famously the founder of Earth Day, but in the Carter administration. He directed the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. During the Reagan years, he spent his time as a professor of engineering and human ecology at Stanford University. He was also a Silicon Valley lawyer. He was named a Time Magazine Hero of the Planet and has received the John Muir Award, the Rachel Carson Medal, the National Jefferson Award. Most importantly for our panel, he also, as the director of the Bullitt Foundation, was instrumental in having the building of the Bullitt Center, which he will tell us about. Thanks, Dennis.
Thank you very much. Just a prefatory remark. By and large, your reporters, you're looking for stories. Stories require tension and not always creative tension. And I'm not sure if Heather particularly wants me to say this or not, but there is one of those stories that is out there right now. This is not entirely kumbaya. Let's have low VOC paint so everybody says, yes, let's go do it. When you require something in a building, suddenly people who are manufacturing something else can occasionally be quite hostile. And there is something very akin to a full-throated attack going on now by the American Chemistry Council and the forest products industry to stop requirements within the federal government and in state governments to have LEED certification, and even in some instances to ban LEED certification. It has just been appalling the way that this thing has gone. It's received very little attention, and I commend it to all of you as something that's worth paying attention to. In terms of context, the reason that we're all here is because the world is rapidly urbanizing. These are some figures. I never know who to trust in terms of population projections, but I think it's just safe to say that the trend has been going on for a long time, and it's accelerating. It's driven by policy, that is to say, simple national decisions that we're going to do this, by climate disruption, by the economic opportunities, how are you going to keep them down on the farm, and by the ecological undermining of world agriculture. It's going to require some massive investments in order to make that transition successfully. When we talk about urbanization, it sometimes is thought of as the great solution to so very many things, but most of the growth is in places like this. It is nowhere near as attractive as we would like it to be, and the better ones are like this, which have a few advantages, but not a place that we all aspire toward. And even if you do it extremely well, like a very prominent southern city, sometimes you have problems that are associated with it. Cities should be designed as healthy ecosystems that are designed on the basis of a couple hundred thousand years of beta testing to try to build ecosystems that are designed for humans. They should have, we think, increasingly living buildings, which is to say LEED plus buildings associated with them. The prizes that are given for architecture are not so much given for environmental sustainability or for functionality. They are given for people who are, for the most part, frustrated sculptors who want to work on a grand scale. And so you see these buildings that are stunning, but are not really, unless in case you're doing a cyclotron, this one would be kind of attractive, but not really designed for particular sorts of purposes. The Living Building Challenge is an incredibly tough set of standards that is based primarily upon performance. LEED looks at the building that is being built, and basically the process currently stops, though I think there are suggestions for ways that it will be going on.
We have a very, very strong program on existing buildings.
No, but I mean, when you're certifying, once you have certified it, it is not an ongoing performance assessment.
Yes, we're moving towards that.
Right. So what the Living Building Challenge's difference is that once you have built a super building, how you operate it is enormously important. And it is not uncommon that a really well-operated LEED Silver will get better performance than a not well-operated LEED Platinum, or that simply it's got something inside it. In the case of the LEED Platinum building, a famous controversial article within the last couple of months about a New York building that has a stock brokerage. And so you've got these people with like six monitors on their desks, and it is like an energy black hole. And you look at it and say, this is supposed to be a LEED Platinum building. It's just an energy suck. Well, you put six monitors on every desk in a building, and you're an energy suck regardless of how well you built it. The Living Building Challenge, and this is the Bullet Center, looks at all of that and tries to achieve such things as you have to produce as much electricity, and since that's the only form of energy these buildings use, the only form of commercial energy, you can pick up some low-grade heat from the ground, as much on-site over the course of a year as the building uses. In Seattle, and it leads to very situational architecture. You have a very different thing in Atlanta than you would have in Phoenix, than you would have in Anchorage. This is a building designed for Seattle, which, as you know, is not hugely blessed with an abundance of sunshine. So we have a roof that looks a lot like a mortarboard at a graduation ceremony. And this is just another angle. And it's to suggest through a few of these pictures that this is not yurts, it's not hair shirts, it's a really comfortable Class A office building. This is a set of charts that I put together that basically shows where typically we find investment barriers. They will be different from building to building and from region to region and depending upon what the stripes are. But basically you start paying a bit of a premium to get to LEED Platinum over what the market will support. So say you build it and immediately lease it and sell it, you can have a rough time getting your full money out of it at LEED Platinum today with conventional economics. And there are all of these additional benefits that can be gotten over in this public and private benefit side, the externalities that are associated with construction. But none of those are harvested within the market as it exists right now. If we could integrate those things, if we could put in something that actually a carbon tax being a perfect example, but you can find all kinds of things having to do with water and materials and toxics and waste disposal and what have you, then suddenly the economics starts to change kind of dramatically. And that's what we are all, I think, on this panel aspiring toward. Typically in a building, you bring in that wonderful, frustrated sculptor. He designs something that is extraordinary. Then they bring in a bunch of engineers to figure out how in the world we'll make it work. And you pump a bunch of energy into it, and it works. And then you bring in the contractor, and he says, you know, that's beautiful, and it will work, and it's going to cost you 200% what you had budgeted. And so they do what's called value engineering, and they shave and pull it together. And finally, you get a building. In ours, what we did instead was figure out how much space we could cover with solar collectors, how much insulation there is in Seattle in a typical year. So we looked at the sunlight for the last 10 years and averaged it out. The one thing that you learn from that, of course, is that there is never an average year. Every single year was someplace other than where the average was. Got the most efficient panels that we could find in commercial production today in the world and decided how many kilowatt hours we could produce in an average year and gave that to people on the very first day of the building as a design parameter. So this shows you in green buildings there's something called EUI, kilobtus per square foot per year. In Seattle, a LEED building that got all of its energy credits and was operated really well a lead platinum building would be an EUI of about 32,000 BTUs per square foot per year. In order to meet our energy budget, we had to slash that in half. And that gives you some sense. People talk about, we have this big dramatic roof, the solar in the building. What's dramatic in the building is really the energy efficiency. There's the roof and the Seattle skyline. One of the nice things about all of these things we're talking about, of course, is that they are jobs that have fair payments attached to them that are completely non-exportable. There is no way that somebody in Brazil or China can build a building in Seattle. And we did it in Seattle. If you look at the solar resource of the country, I don't know exactly how they argue about the Mason-Dixon line, but I have to confess the people that argue about Seattle actually have a little meteorology behind them. This is not an ideal place to put in solar, and if you're looking as well at the cost of electricity, what we have is the place on the contiguous 48 with the cheapest electricity and the least solar. All of which is to say, if you can do it in Seattle, you can do it any place. And this is how we broke it down. It shows the typical building built to code in Seattle versus ours. This shows one of the things that was very important this summer. Our Venetian blinds, if you will, though they are much sturdier than your typical Venetian blinds, are on the outside. So we've got these things on the roof that tell you what's the external temperature, whether it's raining or not, whether the wind is blowing, and if so, how fast and from what direction, how bright the sunlight is, and stuff inside that is monitoring the CO2 buildups and the internal temperature, feeds into a computer that knows where the sun is on the horizon at every hour of every day. We don't know how many clouds are between us and the sun, but that device up on the roof tells you how intense the sunlight is. And all of that tells you whether the window should be open or closed and whether the blinds on the outside of the building should be up or down. This summer, which was an unusually hot summer in Seattle, we had almost certainly the most comfortable building in Seattle. And we have no air conditioning, but it never got above 73 degrees because the heat never made it inside the building. This is the mechanical room. Not much to be said there. We've got 26 geothermal closed-loop wells that feed into a series of heat pumps that run the hot water system for the building and the radiant heating for the floor. We capture all of the rain that falls on the roof and put it in a cistern with 56,000 gallons of storage capacity, filter the Dickens out of it, and after that put it through ultraviolet and then take out anything that's in solution. And then, as I said for those of you that were at the session yesterday, we chlorinate it and run it up through the plumbing and take the chlorine back out as required under the Safe Drinking Water Act. But it's self-sufficient for energy on an annual basis, and it's self-sufficient for water on an annual basis. The water is actually somewhat more real because you can capture rain in October and use it the following June. You can't do that so much for sunlight. I'm missing some of my slides, but that's probably good because I'm going too long. This is our toilet. The important thing about this is that it looks like a toilet. It's a foaming toilet, which means that you don't flush it. It flushes when you sit down, but it does it with foam. If you've blown bubbles for a little kid, a little bit of water gets you an enormous amount of bubbles. They originally said that the average person that comes in and does not read the sports section, but just comes in, does his business, and leaves, would be using about 2 tablespoons full of water. We think it's actually almost a half a cup of water, but it's a trivial amount of water one way or the other. We kept out 362 chemicals that are toxic, carcinogenic, mutagenic, endocrine disrupting, what have you. There are about almost 900 individual components in the building, so we had to build a matrix of 900 components against 362 chemicals. We had an architecture student at the University of Washington who devoted 2 years of his life to this, but now knows more about buildings and materials than probably anybody else on the planet. In addition to the things we had to do under the Living Building Challenge, one of the design criteria that I gave the architects is I wanted to have an irresistible stairway. I don't know how many of you are in the Sheraton. I am. I went down the stairway. My God, it's like a back alley in Bangladesh. That's what it is in every building. You walk in the front door, what do you have? A bank of elevators. Right? If you can find the stairway someplace, they are these reeking, dank, dark places. You go up six stories and the doors are locked and you have to come back down and use the elevator anyway. We wanted to have an irresistible stairway, and effectively everybody uses it. Unless you're disabled, there is an elevator. And the elevator, of course, is a regenerating one. When it comes down, it gets back some of the energy you use going up. But the stairway, when you get up on the fifth floor and the sixth floor of the building on this stairway with the view of the Space Needle and the Olympic Mountains in the background, it is a better view than the CEO's corner offices in many of the places in Seattle. And it really has worked well. And the other thing that I said, in addition to the living building challenge, is I wanted it to be durable. If you're talking about what is the greenest aspect of a building, it may be how long it lasts. In Oxford, the average building is 700 years old. In the United States, the average commercial building has a life expectancy of 50 years. That's just crazy. And the reasons aren't that, you know, they had better materials or they had better engineers. They just didn't have any economists back then. And they built the building and didn't apply a discount rate. It became part of their permanent wealth. And then, in conclusion, these are the things that make this building special. It's the first six-story building in the United States to be truly energy neutral from sunbeams hitting its own roof. Again, it's in Seattle. Come on, Phoenix. Second, we think it is the most energy-efficient office building in America. It meets the Passive House standards, and in fact, the founder of Passive House came and toured it and said he, in his view, that this was a greener building than anything that they had done yet in Europe. It's the first public office building in the United States to use rainwater for potable drinking water, showers, and so forth. And then afterwards, just like the Douglas fir forest that was once there, the water doesn't run down into the streets and into the storm sewers and into Puget Sound. We clean it up afterwards and inject it into the ground right there. One of the slides that was missing was the composters. All of our toilets, that foaming stuff goes down into a composter that we need to take out to the King County compost facilities. We'll empty it about once every 2 years. It's the first commercial structure in the United States to receive project certification from the Forest Stewardship Council, which is to say every piece of wood in the building we can trace to where it came from, and it was produced in a forest that will still be maintaining a healthy ecosystem and producing fiber 5,000 years from now if they continue to meet these standards. Again, a little bit more expensive. Again, very much worth it to us as a society. First six-story building in the world to use composting toilets, that's something that I am currently proud of, and at some point I may be very disappointed in. I have these nightmares about the Carnival cruise lines. And finally, it is the first large commercial structure in the world to attempt to meet the living building challenge. Unfortunately, can't tell you whether we've met it. We have to be fully occupied and operate for a year before we get certified, but I think we're well on our way.
Okay. Thanks so much. And I just wanted to introduce myself, Francesca Lyman, and I've written a lot about green building and sustainable cities, and I wanted to circulate a paper so that people could leave their name and email so that I can perhaps send you contact information for our speakers and other resources that may come up. So Heather made reference to the fact that LEED certification, as well as living building and South Faces Earthcraft, are voluntary certifications. They're voluntary standards. We have some cities and municipalities and counties who are following and asking for some city municipal buildings to be LEED certified or to have green building hallmarks, but at this point I wanted to ask our panelists to what extent the buildings that we know of across the country, commercial buildings and housing stock, to what extent there are codes for green building that are adequate or that are beginning to move in the direction of where we want to go with ultimately highly efficient, you know, even net zero buildings. So I wanted to ask our panelists that.
Well, I'll start with this. There are model building codes out there. For example, Georgia has adopted a model green building code that allows any local jurisdiction in the state to adopt that code. No local jurisdictions have adopted the code. So, you know, there's a difference between having something on the books and having it actually apply. City of Atlanta has adopted an ordinance that allows the potable use of captured rainwater. That's a recent development. I think we'll probably see some movement on that here in the next couple of years in the Atlanta market. So there's, you know, you have codes, but then you have market transformation. And the main focus has been primarily on energy and water, to a lesser extent on codes. And, you know, we're doing a pretty good job in this country about raising the bar on energy codes. You know, we can always do better, but... the Obama administration had that as a priority in the first term, and it's had impact. Here in the Southeast, we've got Alabama and Mississippi states that never had statewide building codes that now have adopted statewide energy codes. So I know as journalists we tend to not look for the good news side, and plenty we can focus on that's not good. But, you know, I think that is something that's happened that's positive in our country, is more states are adopting energy codes. I can argue the other side now if you want, but someone else can argue it now.
Well, we can continue that conversation, but I want to continue to introduce our speakers. I'd like to move on to Robin Rogers, who is an architectural designer and writer who works as a full-time consultant to Community Housing Partners, an affordable housing provider in the southeastern U.S. For more than a decade, she's worked as a consultant in residential, commercial, sustainable design and building, and was a contributor to the development of a national green building standard and guidelines as Built Green Director, Sustainability Director at OTAC, an architectural firm in Seattle, and as a consultant. And she's the designer of a small plan sustainable community with builder Steve Wise near Yakima, Washington, and runs Silverpedia, a website devoted to designing and building sustainably.
And I have the bad news. In affordable housing, Francesca mentioned that I work for Community Housing Partners. So we deal with the people who spend need to spend less than 30% of their income on housing, including utilities. So we work with a lot of very poor, low-wealth, low-income people. We participate in Dennis's programs in Earthcraft. We actually have a few LEED buildings also. We have not done a living building and may never get to that point. Affordable housing just is not quite as sexy as that, you know, which is a fabulous project. We do have a pilot program with Earthcraft that is a zero energy project. One of the problems with that is that in doing the zero energy part, it's so expensive right now. And so for affordable housing, we're basically having to subsidize it. So CHP itself is subsidizing the solar, which is about $20,000 for each unit, and there are 8 units. So it's a huge, huge trade-off, and we've calculated the payoff is about 40 years. Right now, the housing units, I think there are about 132 million housing units in the United States. Well, the really difficult part is that for the rentals, there are about 12 million extremely low-income people in the United States. And the affordable units for them, there are only about 6.8 million. So you can see there's a huge deficit right now in affordable housing. And it's getting worse because home ownership rates have dropped like crazy, because of this whole recession that we've been going through. Well, it's impacted the poor more than any other group by a factor of double. So not only are they much poorer, they've lost their homes, they've lost equity, they've lost their wealth, and many of them are turning to rentals now, which is something that we do a lot of. We also build homes to sell, sort of lower than market rate to sell. But this problem is exacerbated by two, really three huge demographic issues. One is the baby boomers, who are set to become 20% of our population will be over 65 by, I think it's 2030. So, and in 10 years, that means another 10 million people over 65 are moving into the market, and many of them are going to need affordable housing. Well, it's just not there. You know, I mentioned that deficit that was pointed out in the Harvard does a study every year on the state of the nation's housing, and that's what they published just this year. So in addition to the baby boomers, we have what are called the millennials or Gen Y. Well, that is the largest generation ever in American history. There are 95 million of them that are between about 10 and 30 years old now. They have an unemployment rate that is double the national unemployment rate. Their wages, you're one of them. Their wages have been dropping since 2007, so very difficult to get ahead. One in three live with their parents right now. And the student debt ratio for this generation is astronomical. And half of the graduates are coming out of college with debt now, assuming that they even went to college. And that determines how much they can afford in housing. Well, basically they have to pay down a house before they can even buy a house, although a lot of them are homeowners now. And I think we're also looking at one-third of the heads of households now are women. This is another pretty serious demographic shift. Single parents, single women, cannot maintain homes the way, you know, two-parent families used to be able to. You know, you got to have low maintenance, durability, and all that. Excuse me, all that kind of stuff. The suburbs, they are home to 55% of our poor, which I think is staggering. I think, Francesca, didn't you even do an article about that, I think, not too long ago, about the suburbs and the increase in poverty in the suburbs? So we are also, as an owner of many properties, we have about 6,000 units, which is, you know, kind of a drop in the bucket of, you know, all these millions of units that are out there. We have a vested interest in our rental properties to make them more energy efficient. And we are certifying them. Like I said, we've got most of our certifications are with the EarthCraft program. We have an interest in the ongoing performance. We've done some very small internal studies, like one of our studies 2 years ago. We just looked at five properties, weatherized the heck out of these five properties to, you know, to make them more energy efficient. And our goal is always about 30% above code. Three of them performed fantastically. Two of them, same weatherization, did not. They performed below that. And we think that it is because of the residents. So for some reason, two of these properties had residents that never kind of got this whole energy efficient thing. We also had a grant, a federal grant, to do education. So that's part of what we do, is educate tenants as they come in. But anyway, I'm sorry, it's not quite as sexy as the fabulous living building, which I wish I could go see it. But just wanted to give you a small introduction to that. And Dennis can fill in where I've left out.
Okay, first I'm just going to give you a little background on Dennis Creech, who is up here from Atlanta, and he co-founded South Faith Institute in Atlanta, Georgia, in 1978, and has served as executive director for over 30 years. He's recognized as a local and sustainability, having achieved numerous professional awards, including the Atlanta Business Chronicle's Lifetime Achievement Award, Green Law's Lifetime Achievement Award, Energy and Environmental Building Alliance's Legacy Award, and Residential Energy Service Network's Program Leadership Award. But suffice it to say, with these many years in the green building field, he's seen a lot in the South and beyond. And he recently won another award last week, I think, which he can tell us about. But under his leadership, Southface has helped the private sector launch practical market-based sustainability solutions and helped state and local governments across the Southeast adopt policies to encourage sustainable development and clean energy.
So thank you. Pleasure to be here. Let me tell you a little quickly. Place that might give you some context for a couple of my remarks. Being fourth, I'm not the cleanup hitter, but I think I've made some notes to maybe try and fill some gaps here, and I think Francesca's encouraged us to leave time for your questions, and so I'm going to try and do that. Southface, we call ourselves a regional organization. We define the region as if you eat grits or drink sweet tea, you're in our region. So sort of from Texas to Virginia, Florida to Arkansas. We're a regional organization, but we have a few national and even international programs. For example, we're doing a LEED certification in China now. Got a couple in Canada, but the South is really where we tend to focus. We're an unusual nonprofit environmental group for a couple of reasons. We've got 55 folks on staff. We have architecture and engineering and building science expertise. And we do education and research, advocacy work and consulting, focused mostly on the built environment, everything from sustainable community design to green affordable housing. On that. By the way, my office building is a LEED Platinum certified office building that uses 82% less potable water than a typical office building in Atlanta and less than half the energy. We're not a living building, but we're doing pretty good. But the most important statistic is really we got our high performance, 82% less water, less than half the energy, with off-the-shelf products and technologies that are available in the marketplace today. We do have a couple of exceptions to that. We have also a foaming composting toilet for our staff restroom. It's probably the most popular thing on our tour of our building. You know, you get 20 people in a bathroom, boy, you know, it's a lot of fun. So come to Atlanta and visit us. And so the other statistic I like to do, first of all, our energy use averages less than $25 a day. That's total. That's everything in the building, from copiers and printers and computers to heating, cooling, ventilation, and all that. And we had a 500-year rain event 3 years ago in Atlanta. Those of you here maybe remember we had flooding. And so we captured every drop of water that fell on our site, stored it and reused it to flush toilets and for irrigation, things like that. So, and we're a little postage stamp site, a tight site in an urban environment, much like Dennis's building there. I've been asked to focus mostly on housing. And by the way, we try, you know, in the South, we take the NASCAR approach. We try and do everything. We got everybody's banner on our programs. We do LEED for homes. We do the Enterprise Green Communities Program. We do the National Association of Home Builders Program. We have our own green building program called Earthcraft, and we certified about 28,000 green homes over the last decade or two. And so using all the tools that make sense out there. And although we're a bunch of technology geeks, the point I want to leave with you is the barrier to high-performance housing is not technology. We know how to design and build and operate high-performance homes. Yes, there's room for technology improvements. We got a little research project in Lafayette, Georgia, which is, you know, about 45 minutes drive south of here, where we're capturing heat from the attic to use it to heat water in the home. And so there's certainly technology solutions that we can still bring to the market. But our biggest barrier is not the lack of technology. It is market barriers there. Things like, you know, as Robin mentioned, you know, we tend to focus more on the new homes, not the 130 million or so existing homes. You know, most of the LEED certifications, you know, in the residential sector are about new homes. Same is true for all the other green building programs. We don't have much data on how these homes are performing, and so that's been a major problem there. We don't have to data on either commercial or residential buildings. But when you go to buy a house, think about it. You know, what is it that, you know, is there a label on the home that says this is a high-performing green home? And especially an existing home, there's not. You know, you go to buy any other consumer product out there, you know, all the cars out there, you get a miles per gallon label on the cars. You know, you got a UL label or something like that. So it's these high performance features of homes are invisible in the marketplace. The other problem is financing. Even though most energy and water efficiency technologies in residential homes would offer you a 10 to 20% rate of return on your investment. How many of you are getting 10 to 20% rates of return on your investments now?
After taxes.
Yeah. You know, even though we've got great rates of return, most consumers just aren't there, and there's a lot of barriers in the market, lack of available financing. How many of you trust contractors? You know, and so, by the way, it takes more training to cut hair in most states than to be a residential energy efficiency professional. So all got good-looking haircuts, but we need to change that. We need to recognize, the market needs to recognize that, you know, as we say here in the South, you know, two guys in a pickup truck, you know, that makes you an expert. And so we need to change that. And so the industry needs to be moving to credentials, certification-based training. You know, it's interesting. The National Association of Home Builders predicted that as we come out of the housing slump, we're going to see three major changes in the housing industry. Houses would be smaller. People would buy houses closer to where they work so that we would be reducing transportation cost. And that houses would be greener. I'm not so sure that we're seeing these trends right now. We are in some niches. I mean, I suspect up in the Pacific Northwest, you're seeing them more than you are in Kansas. And, you know, oddly enough, everyone always shows, I think that was Atlanta you had in your slide for.
I was making an allusion to Atlanta, but it was Houston that was in the slide.
Well, you know, there's some truth to that about Atlanta, but, you know, frankly, Atlanta has been changing. You know, we are seeing, two of those, trends, and that, you know, we are seeing people choosing housing. We're getting more mixed-use developments, urban walk-ups, you know, kind of development patterns there. What we're not seeing, actually, I said two, I think we're only seeing one. We are not seeing house size being smaller now, and I think that's a function of people are still scared. When I talk to builders out there, volume sells, and even though people might not want just that big box house anymore, when they're buying now in the marketplace, they are scared, and so they're going with the comfort zone of that's what worked in the past, and we've got to overcome that barrier. And we are not seeing green high on the list coming out of this slump, except for in some niche markets. I'm trying to be honest with you, give you some stories, but you know, I think in some markets you're seeing that, but we are not, at least across the South here on that. And so what happened during the slump is I think a lot of the residential builders who were doing green, boy, they're just trying to hang on by their fingernails to make it through. And so in anything that adds to the first cost is something that's tough for them to be doing right now. You know, we went our green building programs have dropped off on the single family side. To me, this is a story too. You know, what's leading the green housing market now is affordable housing. I mean, there has been a huge transformation in this country because of LEED in the commercial building world. But on the residential side, affordable housing is really, I think, helping to transform the market for green. And 3 years ago, guess which state got ranked number one for being the greenest affordable housing program in the country? I think it was you guys. Yeah, four. No, I'm not. It's Virginia and Georgia got ranked. 1 year Virginia got ranked number one, and another year Georgia got ranked number one. And who would have picked those two states? And it's because of the good work on the affordable housing advocacy community to get those states that kind of ranking there. I was going to finish with, I like this idea of the storylines. You know, y'all are looking for stories. I was talking about the good things about code. Now I'm going to get, you know, to me the story on codes is, yes, all the states are adopting building energy codes. But when you look at enforcement, it is pitiful. And so having a code on the books is one thing, but the enforcement is a challenge. And so, and this is a problem in the industry, because if I'm a builder that's trying to do the right thing, and by the way, the code says this is the worst house I can build by law. And so, and if I'm trying to do the right thing, forget green, we're just talking about the worst house I can build by law. If I'm trying to do the right thing and meet the code, and Robin over here is not, I'm at a competitive advantage. And so we're actually incentivizing the lawbreakers because we don't enforce the code. And so that's a story that we need to tell. There's not an elected official in this country that has ever won office by saying, if elected, I am going to make sure that the building code is enforced. And so it's not a priority. And it is a huge problem across the country. This is not a southern problem. Everywhere you go, this is a problem. The good news, I want to give you a bad news story, and now a good news story is health. We always talk about how much these buildings save and all that. We have got pretty good data now, coming from the affordable housing community, that when you do green well, emphasis on well, people are, in fact, healthier in these homes. And so I think that's a story that has not been told, but that needs to be told. So look forward to your questions.
Thanks so much, Dennis. So I'm going to just take my prerogative as a moderator and ask the first question, and that being kind of pulling from what Dennis Creech was saying about obstacles to green building and how that story is not really being told very much, and also the fact that there seem to be certain places where industries are coming in and trying to beat back green building codes. I understand in Florida, there was one of the industries, I think it's sustainable, one of the forestry trade groups tried to turn around the Forestry Stewardship Council certification. So I wanted to ask the panelists, if you see really big obstacles now to continuing the momentum of green building, and if so, what those are, if there are particular examples that you can cite.
State of Georgia, the governor issued an executive order that said no government facilities will are allowed to seek LEED certification. The example of where there's public policy that's trying to hold back the market transformation around green building, specifically around LEED. And the Governor Deal, the current governor of Georgia, issued an executive order. Now, this is not, you know, Dennis is a lawyer, so he can maybe get into the depths of what an executive order means versus it was not a law that was passed, but executive order to all state agencies that they should not seek. They could not use state dollars to pay for LEED certification of buildings.
There was a fairly serious effort some years ago to pass in state legislatures requirements that if you couldn't come up with a compelling reason why not, that you needed to be at least LEED and then fill in the blank, typically LEED silver. Right. And LEED has within it, in the 100-point rating schedule, one point that you can get for getting a certain percentage of your wood coming from something called the Forest Stewardship Council, which has a huge number of participants, but almost none of the really big timber companies. So although you can get 2 points for getting other wood that is local that comes from the others, they were really jealous of this point that only went to the FSC. So they've mounted this assault, and they've now been joined by the American Chemistry Council to roll back that as executive orders, to roll back laws, to do whatever. Tying it to reporting that you've done elsewhere, one really interesting thing, since water is now emerging as another one of the really big issues besides energy that we're looking at in this field, if you go west of the Mississippi, the prior appropriation doctrine in essentially every state gives you no right to the water that falls on your property. This all comes back to the agricultural roots, where somebody has taken water out of the stream downstream and applied it to something, and they've thus got a right in perpetuity. It doesn't make much sense inside cities, and particularly if you happen to be a city that is on a big hill and all of the water that lands on it flows into the streets, into the storm sewers, and directly into Puget Sound. But until 4 years ago in Seattle, it was against the law to use the rain that falls on your own property. In Colorado, there's only one community down near Colorado Springs that has a special exemption to run it on a pilot basis. So to do this, and you know, there's just no better water to get than the water that Mother Nature has evaporated and purified and delivered for free and dumped onto your roof in a pretty good shape. But that's a really interesting thing to take this historic, somewhat mindless law and apply it to urban areas. The tension out in our part of the world is such that Seattle thumbed its nose at the state and bought rain barrels for anybody who wanted to put them underneath their gutters to break the law as a municipally funded effort. But and we've now gotten rid of that law for municipalities on the western side of Washington. But that would be one big obstacle. Final thing, thinking of this in story terms and, again, tying the two different presentations together, some years ago, many of you noticed the riots in Paris from the immigrant community, and it struck us they were suburban riots. We always think of inner-city riots, but Paris is a vibrant city, and if you have enough money, you live more and closer to the city. If you don't have money, you're forced to the outskirts. We're beginning to see that now, at least in the western part of the country.
Same, certainly true here as well.
So we are where we were before hollowing out our inner cities, we are now revitalizing our inner cities. It has all sorts of attractive features for those that can afford to live there, but the people that were living there now are being squeezed out to the suburbs in this reverse donut sort of way. And the people that can then least afford the transportation costs and everything else to get to their jobs inside the city are the ones that are now being squeezed out. It's a I think it's a really important sociological thing that has gotten less attention than it deserves.
Did you want to speak to this, Heather?
No, they covered everything I would have said.
I mean, I guess I would just add that in our particular situation, we are not prevented because of the codes building green. We do it anyway. And it's just a standard part of our practice. To build about 30% more energy efficient, for example, and same with water savings. So our wish and desire would be that the codes will catch up to that so that everybody does it, not on a voluntary basis. That would be an ideal situation.
At the risk of speaking too much, but let me jump in on that a little bit. The codes are in fact set up as the floor underneath it, and they are you do define a code building as the worst building that it's not breaking the law to build. But the other problem with codes is that they are almost all prescriptive. They tell you precisely what you have to do. And if you're trying to do something that is creative and a little bit different, then suddenly it can become an obstacle. In our building, we have far more windows than you're allowed to have in Seattle. In our building, we have solar collectors that reach out, expanding over the sidewalk, which you're not allowed to do. In our building, we're injecting our treated gray water into the ground right there, so it's functioning as part of a natural ecosystem, which you're not allowed to do. There were probably at least 24 things that were simply illegal, that were part of building something that is greener than green. And what Seattle did, but I don't know of anybody else that has done this yet, is to pass something that for a pilot program for the first 12 buildings that are prepared to meet really high performance standards, we were effectively exempted from all of the prescriptive standards except those having to do with fire and safety, which allows those architects who are not frustrated sculptors but people who would really like to design a building that is functioning like a nest in an ecosystem to do things that are really creative. If you don't meet those performance standards, then there are some substantial penalties. But it turns out it's not as hard as you might think it is to meet those performance standards, or as expensive as you think it is.
Anybody else? I just wanted to ask one other question, and that is, we've talked about obstacles. The promise of green building is tremendous. I mean, it's hard for us as reporters to continually write about the next LEED building or the next green building because it's just a continual story. But in fact, it's with the IPCC report confirming climate change and the fact that buildings take so much, it's going to be an increasing story. And I was going to just quote from Ed Mazaria of the Architecture 2030, said that every year we renovate approximately 5 billion square feet. Every year we build new 5 billion square feet. And by the year 2035, approximately three-quarters of the built environment will be either new or renovated. So there's tremendous promise in the next few years as the population grows. So I just wanted to ask the panelists what you see as really the future potential and how reporters can cover this in a way that's new and fresh.
I'll start with, again, my focus is on housing here today. We don't use the climate argument much in our neck of the woods. You know, the reason we exist is because we think climate change is, I don't want to say the greatest risk, but let's put it in the top three risks that society faces. So please hear that. But we usually lead with other things. What we're leading with now is coming out of the housing slump. Is there's solid data that shows that energy-efficient homes had lower foreclosure rates than typical houses. Study done by the Institute for Market Transformation, D.C.-based nonprofit, University of North Carolina, pretty darn good school, that showed a peer-reviewed study, you know, allowing for the demographics of the populations they were looking at. But if you lived in an energy-efficient home, your chances of foreclosure were less. So I think that's the way we need to be communicating, I think, this message as much as a frontal attack on greenhouse gases or climate change. You know, look for the other hooks that will get us to the same place. Dennis mentioned water. Our LEED Platinum certified building, which uses a lot less energy than a typical building, saves more water from the energy efficiency features than we actually do from our plumbing features. Mm-hmm. How does a light bulb save water? Because if you look at it, in Georgia, most of our electricity comes from coal or nuclear power plants, and so they evaporate a lot of water, roughly half a gallon to a gallon per kilowatt hour. And so the energy we save saves more water than the composting toilet or the plumbing fixtures and things like that. So those are the kinds of stories you might look at different hooks.
And I think in addition, the home sales of green homes are shown to be better and to get higher value for green homes, yeah, which is another big positive. I guess another thing that we focus on conservation over renewables, for example, that the energy efficiency that Dennis was talking about is so important to us. It's important to the people who live in our places because they can't afford to pay more. So much of our effort goes into making these really efficient buildings. And we also have a whole training center. So we train people to become EarthCraft certified, Building Performance Institute certified. So we do a lot of that. Education seems to be a really big component, too. If people kind of understand what they're living in or working in, for that matter, there's a better opportunity for them to become stewards of that building, whether it's a house or a commercial building. And so that's another component of our programs, is that education. And probably about half of our properties, we have tenant education programs where we actually teach them about green maintenance.
A couple of thoughts. I mean, you know how to find stories much better than I do, but obviously if we can get a man bites dog story, that's good. I think that it's, well, again, I'm enormously local and it's a very distant part of the country, but in Seattle, arguably the greenest development in the city is low and moderate income housing up at High Point. And they've literally done everything there. And that's not where you expect it. But the Seattle Housing Authority decided that it was going to demand that, and the developers were prepared to be satisfied with a good rate of return, not the highest possible rate of return, and the whole thing has all worked out. So it's, I think there's a story with the fact that those people are doing better than the Microsoft millionaires are doing on the green aspects. Finally, I'd like to just sort of say a word about the economics here. Clearly, the things that you do on the efficiency side, you can push farther and farther and farther, and you get a lower and lower and lower rate of return. But you can do an enormous amount of things before you start getting to the point where solar starts making sense. So, of course, you do all of that efficiency stuff first. But I take a little bit of umbrage at the sense that solar doesn't make sense or that it would take us 40 years to get a payback. That's arguably true as you do the mathematics as it's conventionally looked at, but that's not the way that society ought to look at it. Utilities, as you know, are regulated monopolies, and as a consequence, they do not price at the margin. If you're going to sell an automobile, if you're going to sell anything, you price it at the marginal cost of production. That's where your demand curves and your supply curves cross, is at the margin, not in utilities. So in Seattle, we have incredibly cheap electricity. Why? Because we built a ton of dams in 1930s with Depression-era labor. There are no more 1930s dams with Depression-era labor to be built. The cost of electricity for a peaking unit is the same as it is in Atlanta. It's a natural gas combustion turbine. And that's what you're competing against with solar. It's the stuff that you begin to generate at about 11 o'clock in the morning, and it goes on until about 4:30 or 5 in the afternoon. In the Southwest, this stuff should just be splattered every place because it's actually going to be saving you money. It'll be cheaper to do that amount of your energy budget with solar. And as a consequence, we find ourselves in all of these things where, yeah, if you sort of say, what is the cost of the system? What is the cost of borrowing money to pay for the system? What is the cost of electricity? You have no time-of-day demand charges. Yeah, you'd sort of say this makes no sense. But that's merely because society has set up the wrong price signals, even forgetting greenhouse gases and all of the other attendant problems with conventional energy sources as opposed to, and I have to confess, I am a solar zealot, in case it wasn't obvious. But, my God, it's something that lies there. It produces no greenhouse gases. It has absolutely no mine tailings to go down. It's not going to produce any radioactive substances. It'll produce no bomb-grade materials. It'll have no oil spills. It doesn't even have any moving parts that can break. It just lies there and gives you power. I think it's worth paying a premium for that if you have to. And you certainly should be doing it when you don't have to.
And there's that argument. I'm also a very big solar proponent. When people go to buy a car, you know, do they say, what is the payback on this BMW? No. You know, you just don't. So there is that component. Now, we're constrained because much of our funding comes from federal sources, so we have to be able to justify what we're spending money on. And in some cases, we've got limitations, but there are affordable builders out there who either don't or who do it anyway. High Point, excellent example. It's a beautiful community.
So. Yeah. One thing I wanted to say about High Point, since I wrote an article on it, they built this fantastic community, and you know, with built green, it was in every way, and solar in places, but there's no grocery store. Somehow they were not able to get the community to you know, welcome it in the way, you know, to have, let alone codes, just you know, to plan it, you know, urban planning, but. Is there anything else you want to say, Heather?
Sure. I would like to add to what the other panelists have been talking about.
Sure. There's been a lot of mention of codes and the need to improve codes for green, but I want to add on to what Dennis was saying around there are codes out there that actually prevent you from building green. There are amazing practices, usually around water, that are absolutely preventative to water efficiency. I lived in Nashville for 5 years, and very, very proud of the Nashville water folks there, because they were actually looking at those and very, very generous about giving exceptions to that, although I'm not sure yet if that code has actually been changed to allow it. So that's one thing, is to look at these just kind of silly laws out there that keep us from being able to do something that's better for costs, better for the planet, better for the people who live and work within the buildings. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about is just the direction that LEED is going and other rating systems out there are going, which is ongoing performance tracking of buildings and education of the, not just the staff who maintain the buildings, but also the occupants who work in those buildings and live in those buildings, because it doesn't matter how well you design a building to be energy efficient, water efficient, if it's not being run in that way, if the occupants aren't using it in that way, then you're not going to meet that design that was originally planned. One of the most important things you can do for a building to ensure that it's running around energy efficiency is ongoing commissioning of your building, which is where you're looking to make sure that your building systems, when you design a building system, you have certain controls that affect the air circulation, temperature controls. But most buildings don't continue to look and make sure those controls are set at the right level and continuing to maintain the building in that way. So, again, operation of buildings, how they're operated, is really, really important. And so that's the direction that LEED's going in now, is to continue to track performance in real time.
Thanks a lot.
Well, I think it's time. You had a question.
Yeah, I'm about, I think we should open this up to everyone. So go ahead. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, no, we have a little extra time. We have a little extra time, which is why I let it run.
Well, Heather, I'm comfortable. What it looks like that panel, I think that LEED is not sufficient, that it's inadequate, particularly as we, as more and more LEED becomes the goal, is it not good enough?
I'll take that on at least a little bit. I think what LEED has done in the marketplace is to totally transform people's thinking about buildings. One of the good things about it is that it's constantly changing. Is it enough right now? I don't think so. But that's one of the beauties of the way it's set up, is that it's designed to be improved and to change over time.
Dennis?
Yeah, I think the answer is yes, it's not enough. And version 4 is, you know, it's, you know, changed every few years, and, you know, and you know, not to speak for Heather, but, you know, LEED has as I recall, you know, there's the curve where y'all are trying to sort of move the top 25% of the market forward. I mean, that's the goal. You know, Dennis's building, the Living Building Challenge, has a very different goal than LEED. And, you know, I think we need all these tools to help transform the market. LEED has been the most transformational force in the market in the 35 years that I've been in this business. And so, and you know, I think it will continue to be that force. We need it to be that force.
If you've got a lousy building and you try to run it just as efficiently as possible, you're mostly sacrificing. I mean, you're wearing coats in the office because it's freezing. You're doing the old-fashioned conservation instead of efficiency. And if you build the building really well and you operate it very poorly, then you have spent a whole lot of money and you're not getting the necessary benefits from it. And I think what's going on with LEED right now is that they've put appropriately a whole lot of effort into the things that they could control, and their particular constituencies, the folks that founded it and built it, wanted. But now we've recognized that, okay, you've got that building, you've got to help it recognize its full potentiality, and it's evolving in that direction. Candidly, with the Living Building Challenge, we went with this integrated design process where right from day one we had the architectural firm, we had the general contractors, we had the developers, we had three different engineering firms and the solar specialists. Everybody was in weekly meetings for a year and a half. And it sort of got us into this position where it was no surprises. But I learned after that was all over, okay, but that's the way that you ought to do LEED. If you're going to do Living Building Challenge, we should have also brought in the building engineers that are going to be operating the building, because we've learned all sorts of things in commissioning that simply didn't occur to any of the people in this broad integrated resource planning team that we had up front. You know, there's just different kinds of expertise. There's been a tendency in a lot of places to be more critical of LEED than LEED deserves. I've been one of the people who've been critical of various aspects of it, but in fairness to them, we have now seen in Washington, D.C. what happens when the public understands how sausage is made. We've all gotten kind of disgusted by the federal government. LEED has been pretty transparent up front, so we've seen all of those kinds of problems. It possibly would have been better if some things had emerged without all of us knowing all of the struggles and all of the personalities and all the stuff that went on behind it. But I think it's like everybody else on the panel. It's been a huge force to move things in the right direction.
And I can share with you some of the articles that have been critical, that have shown the examples of buildings that have not performed as well as advertised. But now that I have all your emails, I think, Alan, you had a question?
Yes. I think Dennis spoke to this a little bit, but I'd like to see a little bit more reflection about the floor, the International Building Code, if I'm not mistaken, and what are the challenges within that policy setting more rapid advancement, or maybe it's moving as fast as possible we can, but could you speak to that floor a little bit?
Well, the challenges with, you know, the code process is the same as the challenges with LEED, I think, and the same as the challenges with, you know, ASHRAE standards and all that, is, you know, you're trying to get a lot of different players involved, and they all have their sort of special interest, and they all have something that they're trying to get out of the code, and so, you know, it's not about building science or policy on greenhouse gases. It's about who wants their product or their industry to be favored. That's the biggest challenge with the code. I don't know if that's where you wanted me to go, but I'm struggling here for something.
The states all have different codes. We don't really have a national.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for example, I'll use Georgia and Virginia as examples. We both adopted the 2009 International Energy Conservation Code. Every state adopts a code with amendments. Georgia actually strengthened the code by requiring diagnostic testing on residential buildings. You actually, I don't want to get too deep into this, but, you know, every home has a test on the plumbing system. The plumber puts the pipes in, and you have to have a pressure test to make sure your pipes don't leak. Well, you don't have that kind of testing on other systems in the homes. The duct system for your heating and cooling equipment is being one. So Georgia adopted the code that said we've got to do those diagnostic tests, which are required by the code. Virginia adopted the same code with amendments that said, we don't have to do those tests. Now, would you want a home that didn't have the plumbing pipes tested? I think that was for me. So, you know, that's the challenge with codes, is that although we have international codes or national codes, states adopt different versions of them.
Okay, but just as a coda to that, and I know you got to cut this off, it's also very important that they should. I mean, there are totally different climatic regimes, there are totally different kinds of cultures, there are all sorts of reasons that states should. If you look back 50 years ago, you could look at a picture of an office building in Atlanta and an office building in Phoenix and an office building in Anchorage, and they would look very different. And now they all look the same. It was better when they looked different. Now we're just pumping a lot of energy in to cool the one, to heat the other, to dehumidify the third. You ought to be designing with climate, and codes make that possible. Dennis's early point about enforcement, I think, is just crucial. We can get so much done if you simply have people who will rigorously enforce what is, hell, I sound like I'm with the NRA, but enforce the existing laws.
Yeah, our problem is not having good enough codes. Our problem is not enforcing the ones we have.
I think Heather wanted to respond to the LEED question, but we had one more question. Did you have a question, Peter?
Yeah, Peter Crowley. We've all seen examples of individual buildings where there's been a disconnect between the models of performance and the actual performance. I'm wondering, what is your various takes on how generalized a problem that is, and whether, as a broad rule, the performance expectations have been overstated? And if that's the case, is that a problem of modeling mainly, or a problem of how the buildings are operating and commissioned?
Love to jump in on that one.
Sure.
Yeah, that was actually you got to the comment I was going to make about the previous question regarding LEED. The models are predictive. They are to say this is exactly how it's going to happen. Ideally, when you're, let's say around energy, when you're doing energy models, that's so you can run different scenarios as you're making decisions about what type of equipment you're going to put into your building. You can design a building to run incredibly efficiently. You can design it to be net zero, but if it's not being operated in that way, then it's not going to function in that way. So that's one of the reasons that LEED is now becoming very, very focused on operations and maintenance of buildings and giving, looking at it both prescriptively in order to teach the building operators out there best practices to follow, as well as to be looking at performance. And we actually require that water and energy data is submitted to us and is tracked. The existing buildings program now has a requirement that if you want to keep your LEED status, you have to recertify your building every 5 years at a minimum. And that's because so we can look at that building and say, are you following the policies and programs to operate and maintain this building that you originally stated that you were going to use? I think in the future, and this isn't something that's fully decided at this point in time, but probably in the future we're going to be moving towards getting new construction buildings in order to maintain their LEED certification, moving towards existing buildings and recertification. So essentially ongoing certification is what, you know, the future of LEED is looking towards, and looking towards real-time tracking of performance.
And could I add something? We're right now investigating energy management systems. So we're retrofitting our headquarters building with energy management, and we're considering installing those in all of our buildings if it works. I mean, if it gives us the right information back.
One of our building modelers on our staff has a great quote. Says, you know, modeling the energy performance of the building, this ain't rocket science. It's harder because there's people involved. You know, and so you're really not modeling just a building. You're modeling how people are going to perform in that building. And that's where the challenge comes in.
It's like, you know, rocket science when we used to send the chimps up before the people.
Yeah, it's like, you know, miles per gallon on the car. You know, your miles will vary. You know, if you drive like me, you're going to get less.
With these building systems as well, they typically have dashboards associated with them. And just with the Toyota Prius, if you put that little thing in there that tells you what your mileage is, but you don't have a hybrid, you just have the little dashboard, everybody gets better mileage because you're moving against that. I think it'll be the same sort of thing when you give feedback. We in our offices have something where we can tell, it goes into my computer, a little Bluetooth communication from every single socket in the office. Somebody brings in a space heater, I knew it in 5 seconds. I mean, it's literally there. And that feedback is important. I've actually got a story for you. It's late, and so I will just give you a hint of it. Every utility in the country, it's no secret at all, though nobody much thinks about it. If you're going to build a building, the utility will come in and give you some money for doing better than code. And it's, you know, just for a series of specific things. In our case, the utility came in and took a look at what we were going to do, and they said they'd give us $70,000. We told them we didn't want that money, because we were going to be doing a whole bunch of things that they wouldn't pay for anyhow, and negotiated with them instead a metered savings plan. So that then this goes back to what you were saying about modeled behavior and how buildings should and shouldn't perform. We will look at every building that is our size in Seattle that was built to code and find out how much energy they used. And then we'll normalize that for the weather during the years that we were looking at their energy bills and for how many people were in the building and for what kinds of things they did. And we've got a program that actually lays all of that out and gives you what in Seattle under this set of circumstances will be the energy consumption of a building built to code. And then we will sell to the utility the energy that we use less than that. And it will be hugely valuable to them because it's just like buying energy from a wind farm. We're already going to be paying them for the electricity, whether we use it or not, that a code building would do. But they will buy back from us the electricity within that we don't use. And because it's not sort of giving them electricity when the wind's blowing, we're giving them electricity at the highest point of the demand peak, because our building is just like every other large commercial building in the city. For them, it's worth retail plus 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour. So if we behave the way our predictive models say that we should, and the way that I'm going to be whipping people to make sure that they do, instead of getting $70,000 up front, we've entered into a 20-year contract that we think will give us $40,000 a year for 20 years and gives me a really strong incentive to keep this efficiency moving on into the future. It's that sort of thing more than bringing creative new approaches to this will get you all kinds of desirable outcomes. We just need people doing stuff that's innovative and see if it works.
Thank you. Well, we've been told we need to cut off. I think we have room for one more question, but we have 15 minutes of free time and treats before the next session. So if people want to ask questions, we can still do that. I'd love to leave a little time for our speakers to give closing remarks if they want. So if you want to ask your question, we still have time for that.
I'd rather have the questions than give up
tomorrow. Okay. Yeah. Okay, John?
I'm curious about applying the living building model and the plot model code to existing homes, existing housing stock. There was a great quote yesterday with Dennis Ava for how much new building might have to occur in China. But like in the United States, in a city like Seattle, it's homes that are 100-year-old craftsmen, how do I make that house sort of up to a living building code? Is it possible, or is it better to raise the building and put in something new and modern?
So the question is, how would you apply these standards to an existing home, or is it easier to just tear it down and start from scratch?
So it's always a little bit more challenging to change the building that's already there. But you're locked into certain materials that are in your home too, I guess you can strip out all the insulation, but I don't know, PVC pipe or whatever. I would say it's probably doable to at least get pretty far along in something like the Living Building Challenge, because you can retrofit your water systems pretty easily. You can add rainwater collection system. You can do, innovative plumbing systems. You can add solar power or, whatever. So I think that it's possible. It may be somewhat pricey.
5 minutes, so we're going to have a break.
Okay, sorry.